Can we please look at the text document that you sent?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So generally speaking, when you think of mixing, everything is about context. And the first bullet point is infinity. People ask, well, how do you mix? Well, there isn't one way that you mix. Mixing is a process. And so there is no magic formula or recipe to doing it, other than if you're going to do a good job, you have to use every shred of knowledge that you possess, and you have to be creative as much as possible with the images that you're trying to put together. So, you know, in this era where, thank goodness, you know, automation is so absolutely inclusive of everything that you do, you really need to start thinking about mixing when you're putting together your production plan. So if you're mixing for yourself, you know, you can keep it kind of loose. But if you're working for a client, the first thing I do when I'm working on a project is I have a meeting or a series of meetings with the client to try to get to understand what they want out of the recording. Is it, you know, is it an artistic manifesto? Is it something where they are going to dig down to the, you know, the bottom of their roots and try to find out who they are? Or is it that they want, you know, an expeditious recording that they can sell at gigs that represents what they do at their gigs? Or what is it exactly?
Right.
Another bullet point is there that's on this list is that mix preparation begins before the computer is turned on. You have to begin at the end, determine the goal of the project, and work backwards from there. Generally speaking, more tracks means more time spent mixing. If you don't have a sizable budget, then think minimally in terms of track count, recording methodologies, number of Pro Tools sessions, et cetera, et cetera. And what I mean by that is if the client is just penniless and they really don't have any business starting an album, and you know that money is going to be a crisis day in and day out, which it is more often than it isn't these days, then, you know, maybe you can't shoot for the moon. Maybe you have to pare it down and work towards making something that they can actually afford to pay for, because otherwise it's just going to be super frustrating for everybody. For instance, a really great way to try to keep your budget in check, and this is not necessarily, it's not necessarily going to be giving short shrift to the process. But if you know you don't have a lot of time, then instead of putting three microphones up on the guitar amp, put up one and live with it. Instead of putting up spot mics on the drum kit, take the Glenn Johns approach and put up three mics, and so on and so forth, so that you can keep the economy of scale relevant to the overall part of the process, you know, the budget part of the process and the amount of time you have to spend. You can also think of this in terms of, you know, one technique that I use frequently is instead of making individual sessions per song, because if you make individual sessions per song, then you record, let's say you record basic tracks for a dozen songs in a session or a group of sessions. If you make individual sessions for each song, that means that you're going to have to instantiate or import your processing. If you're trying to do batch job and make the drums sound the same from song to song, which is the efficient way to do it in that process, that indicates that you need to treat it like a live recording and just record all the songs into one session, build the processing into that one session, and then if you have the luxury of doing automated mixing and getting more specialized per song, do it after you've built the grid for all of the common instruments in the recordings. So, you know, again, there are ways to manage the process along the way that honor your client's needs, their budget, the speed at which they need to have things done. You know, it may not be the be-all, end-all in terms of how you might think it would be best to present their work. But, you know, if they can only afford a hot dog, then don't make steak Diane. You know what I'm saying? You know, give them what they're able to pay for. So one of the other bullets, backtracking just a hair, is when mixing for a client, the entire production must be predicated on their needs, both artistic and financial. And that is truly, in my opinion, the most important, and historically, this is what a producer was in the beginning of the music business. A producer was the person that kept the project within budget and on time. The concept of producer has evolved greatly and is much more involving on an artistic level at this point than it was historically. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the producer who understands the process in and out. I mean, you know, the producer has probably got, you know, a good producer's probably got a few hundred projects under their belt. They understand how projects work. Whereas an artist, Springsteen just released his, 18th album? So, you know, hundreds versus 18th, and he's at the top of his game, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, you have a perspective that is invaluable to your client, and that's the perspective that you need to kind of, you know, you need to take control of the things that are likely to end up being problems later on, like running out of money, because it happens all the time. Okay, so faster paths. We talked about treating it like a live recording and putting all of the songs into one session. So, and the bullet point for that was fastest path, treat it like a live sound event, one single session, depending on budget, either turn into individual sessions after the whole board is set up or not. If you're really pressed for time, you might just have to set the faders up at a particular level and just bounce the tracks out once you've got your EQ and a little bit of processing set up. And if you're uncomfortable with doing that, then you shouldn't take the job in the first place. Another fast path to shortcutting mixing is to use compression to replace in-depth leveling. Now, this is something I hate to do. But again, if you take a job and you're responsible to your client and the client says, I'm giving you 45 minutes per song to mix this album, well, it takes me more than 45 minutes to level a vocal. And so if you know you can't level the vocal, all you can do is just, if there's, you know, a stanza that's too low or, you know, a particular section that just has to be manually leveled, then yeah, you'd have time to do that. But other than that, you're going to have to compress. And that's just the way it works.
Hey, Bruce, a couple questions on that. Number one, what are your go-to compressor plugins for something like this?
To be honest with you, the only compression I use in Pro Tools at this point is L1 and L2 limiters.
Okay.
I do all my compression outboard at this point. Well, I take that back. I occasionally, if I don't have the ability to use an outboard compressor, I'll use Smack. But one other. I take it back. I use the Focusrite Red Range compressor limiter for ducking. But I only use it for ducking.
From a mixing standpoint, what you're saying is you will often insert hardware compressors in the mix process. And then you're up to either having to print or document on paper or something.
Indeed. I tend to print because it's my workflow. Also, I tend to not insert compression in the sense of I don't instantiate an insert and put it in the insert. I only do that on the master bus.
So when you talk about faster path, you use compression to replace in-depth leveling.
Well, in that particular case, yes, I would. Yeah, and this is part of the my first bullet point of infinity, depending on the project. But if I'm going to outboard compression, which I probably wouldn't do on a fast, if I was really, really trying to work super, super fast, I probably wouldn't take the time to insert hardware compressors. I probably would go with, you know, Smack and... L1 and L2.
And if you're producing this, you'll use compression and limiting in the acquisition phase to optimize the recordings at the point of capture a lot of times, right?
Yes, I do that. I do it somewhat minimally, though, because you can't uncompress later. The way that I tend to use compression in a mix is to assign the output of a fader to a hardware output and then take that out to the compressor and then bring that in on a new audio track. And then by the time I'm done mixing a particular group of tracks that are I use outboard compression on, then I'll just print those tracks and make sure that they're time aligned. The reason I do that is because compression is, by definition, input level sensitive. And so by instantiating a compressor on an insert, you don't have the ability to control the level hitting the compressor.
Right.
Whereas after the fader, you can level the track. I mean, so my typically the way that I will level a lead vocal, which is something I pretty much try to talk my clients out of not giving me the ability to level a lead vocal. If nothing else happens, to me, that's sort of the basis of a decent mix, is that the lead vocal needs that much attention. So what I'll do is I will level a lead vocal without compression inserted. And then I will insert, and then I'll, change the output to the hardware output, bring it in on the new fader, and monitor it with the compressor inserted, and then touch up the leveling as it comes through the compressor, because that way I'm using the compressor to sculpt the sound and not use it just to control level. Whereas if I'm working super fast and I have to use the compressor to control level, well, then what I generally tend to do is I will put an L1 first in the inserts and control the peaks so that I'm not slamming the input of the compressor. And then I'll put a compressor in to sort of round it out and give it body. And that's how I do a fast job.
So that's great. Actually, you touched upon a few things. One is having fluent competency in signal routing to be able to insert compressors and limiters at different stages of the signal path, whether it's pre or post fader and whatnot, and being able to monitor those levels. And that's like a whole skill set that's very important for students to get a handle on. It's an example of the technical side of things, I think, that is tangible.
It relates to the art, though, in the sense that compression is a insanely cool sculpting tool.
Yeah.
Where you can really change the inherent density and vibe of a track by how you treat it with compression. And so where you insert the compressor and how you alter the signal before it gets to the compression is a huge component of sculpting the sound.
I agree. And another thing is there's automation involved. When you talk about leveling the lead vocal, primarily you're talking about using Pro Tools automation, creating breakpoints in essence, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how long does it take you to level an average 4-minute lead vocal song?
Just about an hour.
And by the way, have you checked out, are you familiar with some of the plugins that will generate those breakpoints automatically, like WaveWriter, I think one of them is called? Are you hip to those?
Oh boy, no, I'm not.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I just got a demo of this, and I bet they'd give you an NFR also. I'm going to try it out. It's gotten really amazing reviews. Well, basically, you can set it to generate automation data on a given track. I'm really excited to check that out. But it kind of underscores the category of automation as a very important body of information for students to master, because that's such an integral part to what we're doing in mixing, obviously. Automation is a big one, and I think we don't have time to cover everything today. And I don't even know if you put the word automation on your...
Oh,
I see it.
I see it. It's in there.
Okay. But I mean, a lot of this stuff is inherently linked to automation. And,
I mean, if you're going to make art with audio, I mean, this has been the case well before digital audio workstations, you know, exactly. I mean, I remember the Roland, there was a Roland VCA add-on that crashed, inevitably would always crash 5 minutes before you were going to finish your mix and lost all the data way too many times. But, you know, just being able to automate mutes and levels, which was the, you know, the first few systems that I worked on.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what a huge difference. I mean, and when you watch like a Grammy award winning or a Platinum award winning engineer mixing on an SSL, it's a robotic dance, you know? So yeah, automation is
a robotic dance in that they are entering and massaging automation data.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if I may make a little plug, one of the best ways to learn about automation is to simply read the chapter about automation in the Pro Tools manual.
Mixing begins before the first track is recorded. My preferred premix setup method includes, number one, organize the tracks such that you won't have to waste time looking for anything. And since probably most of your students are doing pop music, I wrote, for pop music, I choose to organize mine from top to bottom: drums, percussion, bass, chordal instruments, melody instruments, solos, lead vocals, and backing vocals. So anytime I open a session that I have been working on, if I've left it, you know, sometimes I move tracks around so that I can compare the visual of one track to another track. But generally before I close the session down, I'll have put it back in that order so that I always know quickly how to get from one place to another.
By the way, do you tend to use colors for organizing your tracks or just keeping them in order?
I don't generally tend to use colors. It's just not, it wasn't part of Pro Tools when I first started using Pro Tools, and I just haven't really adapted to that particularly. I can see how it would be a good idea, but it, for whatever reason, it just has never been something important. Number two, grouping. Usually created at the time of tracking or overdubbing when you're creating new tracks, but also creatable later. Nonetheless, by mix time, group and or subgroup instruments that are inherently of a group. So, for instance, with a drum kit, I'll group the entire drum kit so that I can quickly record enable or put it in input or mute or grab a fader and grab the whole kit and bring it up or down. But I will also group subgroups within the drum, the major drum group. I'll group, if I've got a pair of distant stereo mics, I'll group them. If I've got a pair of cymbal mics or a trio of cymbal mics, I'll group them. If I've got a pair or trio of tom-tom mics, I'll group them. If I've got a couple mics on the kick or snare, I'll group them. So that once I've got inner relationships between multiple microphone images, I can quickly and easily change their level within the overall level. Okay, so three, subgroup audio tracks as desired for either a submaster for a variety of conveniences, including the ability to have both automated and manual level control on the same tracks for easier level or trim control, or to facilitate being able to easily and resource economically set up sends for spatial or dynamic effects to be grouped for grouped sounds. And what that all means is, okay, so let's say that you have a multiple microphone array on, let's say, an acoustic guitar or a guitar amp, and you want to be able to put a particular compression on that. In order to do that, you have to subgroup it, assign it each track to a bus, and bring it, well, either to a bus or to an output for hardware compression, so that you can bring it back into a new fader, either a bus or a new audio track, or, you know, or a return for being able to instantiate a stereo compressor on it, or, you know, route it to a hardware stereo compressor or mono compressor, if the case may be. But in order to get individual sounds grouped together to process, they have to be sent through a common bus or output.
That's good.
Number four, create sends and returns for spatial processing. So I almost always have either a room simulator or a reverb, at the very least. I almost always have one of those instantiated in my session. And this might be because my room is a small room and I like the sound of more expansive, room ambience than I'm able to do in my room. But this is true also when I work in a big room, even if I'm recording distant images, I almost always have one or more spatial effects processors hooked up. And so if you're going to do this, you're likely going to want it from day one. Most vocalists like a little bit of ambience on their vocal when they're recording. Mm-hmm. You'll need to set up a send off of the source tracks that sends to a return that has the reverb that you want or the delay or whatever instantiated on it. Number five, create a master fader. And now it's not critical that you create a master fader immediately, but the benefit to creating a master fader immediately is that you immediately start to become aware of your overall levels within the session, because it's very easy, especially for younger engineers who don't have a lot of experience, to experience something called fader creep, which is where things sound better when they're louder, so you keep turning them up mm-hmm. until they don't sound good anymore because you're overloading the stereo bus. And especially historically with Pro Tools, so many people have been up in arms about the sound of the stereo bus in Pro Tools because it's digital. It does not accept overflow in a friendly way. Yeah. So if your individual track faders and returns are overloading the master bus and you don't have, and you're not looking at your hardware and you don't have a master fader instantiated in the session, you won't necessarily know if you're overflowing or not. And case in point for me, I generally tend to, do the command click on the window underneath the master fader to change the read from fader position to peak read. And I generally tend to push that fader up maybe 3 dB or so at the beginning of a project so that I build in a little bit of headroom for myself.
That's a good tip.
So that if I do experience fader creep, I can recover from it without having to, go to every track in the session and scale everything downward. So those are the things that I think of before I ever even start recording. Those are the things that I have built into my session that are very useful as you start to mix. So my next bullet point is when all tracks have been recorded and all editing completed, of course you will have built this environment along the way, and now it's time to start looking at the overview. So number one, cleaning. Manually scour each and every track for extraneous noise. Use head and tail fades and crossfades to eliminate the possibility of digital clicking. This is something that I'm often surprised by tracks that I get in for mixing, that this has not been done, because it's a very curious thing. It's way improved over the years that I've been using Pro Tools. But historically, if you did not crossfade, it wasn't consistent that you would get clicking from regions that were not in and out and crossfaded. So you could be working away and not hearing any clicking, and then suddenly clicking would rear its ugly head. Now, I don't know why that would be the case. It doesn't make intrinsic sense to me, but I have experienced it, and so I know it to be true. And this dates way back into analog for me. The first thing that I would do in an analog mix would be to go through, and this was based on tape hiss back in those days, I would go through and mute every channel when it wasn't being used, because it meant that I'd have a lower noise floor and better resolution and clarity.
You do an automation pass using the automation to mute the tracks on the console.
Back in the old days, yeah. I mean, it actually ended up needing to be a number of passes usually, because even if you had a few people at the board, because, you know, 24 tracks and how many fingers, you know, and how much, you know, mental bandwidth. Pro Tools makes this so easy. It's insane to not do it. And so if you're preparing tracks for someone else to mix, it's only courteous to take care of this before it goes to them. Number two, check phase alignment. Phase alignment has a profound effect on the way sounds fit together. This is a regular part of my MO. I still learn things about, you know, after I've been working on a track for a while, it's like, oh, those two things are not as phase aligned as they could be. Oh, one of those waveforms is upside down compared to the other. So you need to be really careful about that, because in terms of robustness to a track and spatial imaging and the ability to translate to mono, if that happens to be the case downstream, it's just hugely important. So again, check phase alignment. It has a profound effect on the way sounds fit together. Be especially careful with multiple signals which combine to form one sound, i.e. drum tracks or a bass DI in combination with a mic'd amp or whatever. Mm-hmm. Number three, if your system offers it, engage delay compensation. This is another thing. If you have multiple images where you are changing their phase relationship by virtue of instantiating plugins, you're going to end up throwing images out of phase and you're going to lose robustness as a result. So if you don't have delay compensation, you need to research the delay in each of your instantiated plugins, and you need to literally time your tracks by sliding them, nudging them upstream the number of samples that you are delayed. Number four, if you've been responsible for the recording of the tracks, you should already have a good working mix in progress. If you haven't been responsible for tracking editing, then you need to get up to speed real quick. So what I generally tend to do when I get a project at mix stage, using just faders and whatever processing has already been built, I'll listen to the mix and get a rough mix without entering automation. That's step one. Number five, start messing with pan. Figure out how the sound balances from left to right. Pan is one of those things like setting up a compressor and like setting up an EQ that so many newbies don't grasp. It's like, I just did a project with a guy who said, but I like the way it sounds when everything is in the center. That's the way it sounds like to me. And it's like, but that's, you know, you're not taking advantage of the stereo field at all. It's one of the big, big, big artistic tools that we have at our disposal, is how sounds relate to one another in the stereo field. And, you know, even more so if you're working in surround. Number six, what I call the bump theory. This is when you start to get into the nuts and bolts of mixing. The bump theory, to me, it's a phrase that I have coined. When you listen to something and something jumps out at you as being out of place, it's like a bump in the road. It's a distraction. And, you know, especially if you're on a limited budget for mixing and you can't afford to get everything exactly how you want it, you have to get those things that really stick out. Let's just, you know, for example, you have a lead vocal that, where the lead vocalist, you know, had his eyes closed and was off mic for a little while and the vocal is getting lost. Well, that's a bump. I'm losing the vocal. Or even more to the point, the vocalist had his eyes closed and leaned into the microphone and then had a moment where he was, you know, shouting at the top of his lungs, and you have, you know, and hopefully you caught that in the recording process and there's no distortion, but, you know, you're going to need to pot that down. So, you know, take care of the big bumps, and mark my words that once those big bumps are out of the way, the next level of bumps is going to be sitting there waiting for you, and so on and so forth until you have gotten down to the, you know, the final aspects of the mix. Number seven, in some cases, manually mute tom tracks around tom hits, especially in a rock production where you have big statements on the tom-toms, where there aren't that many toms being used in the course of the tune, and where the sound of extraneous, leakage from other sound sources is getting into those tom mics. Case in point, a lot of drummers have a ride cymbal very close to the floor tom. If you want your toms to have that sort of, larger than life, like Elton John kind of impact in the mix, or, Ringo Starr kind of impact in the mix, then manually cleaning the audio away from the edges of the toms is a very good thing to do. Now, if there's a tom groove in the tune, you're not going to be able to do that for the most part. You aren't going to want to do it, and you're not going to be able to, because you'll be, there's not going to be much area where there aren't toms. Jazz tunes, likely that it's not a applicable technique. Number eight, if time allows, optimize the sound of each track using EQ. Due to budget, this is a luxury on some projects. For me, it's a meditational process that gives me time to get to know each track intimately. My feeling regarding EQ is that this is the time to optimize each track, most especially to reduce lower mid cloudiness, both within the individual track, but also ultimately to enhance the overall clarity in the mix, because lower mids add up quickly in a mix. And to me, that's the place where you get clarity in a mix, is to take care of them post-haste. Generally, EQ begins with scooping out lower mids, then mid-mids, then sculpting bass, either in an additive or subtractive way. Then the same with upper mids, and then adding air with a high shelf if necessary. As the mix progresses, you may need to EQ again, but this initial EQ is about essentially reducing problems within the EQ of each track and kind of optimizing each track so that it's clear and speaks well on its own. But as you begin to add them together, you may need to revisit the EQ and touch it up a little bit in order to make things live well with one another.
Hey, Bruce, can you please give us some frequency hertz in numbers when you're talking about mids and mid-mids and bass and upper mids and high shelving?
Sure. Lower mids for me would indicate anywhere from as low down as, 125 up to maybe as high as 325. Mid-mids, I would go as low as, 175 up to 500 or so. High mids go, generally speaking, we're talking somewhere in the area of, sometimes I find myself wanting to boost anywhere from about 2,500 to 4,500. And then depending on where I'm at with high shelving, if I'm using a high shelf, that the high shelf might start as low down as in the 3,000s. It might start up in the 6,000s. It might start in the 8,000s, depending on the context. And, if I'm using a semi-parametric, my favorite EQ is the Sony Oxford. And in the Sony Oxford, the high frequencies are switchable between a shelf and parametric. And sometimes I most often use the shelf, but I sometimes do use the parametric if I need a real specific attention in the upper frequencies. Number nine, leveling. Using volume automation both to get a good read on focal images such as vocals and to create the relationships among the sounds. Automated leveling. Automated leveling is the holy grail in creating an artistic mix. With respect to a lead vocal, like I said, if I don't have the time to do any other, you know, sculpting of levels, I will lobby heavily with my clients to allow me to do that, because the vocal in a vocal centric tune, the vocal is it's the foundational element in the mix. Everything else relates to the vocal. Everything works from the vocal, around the vocal, is subject to the vocal, might be ducked by the vocal. The vocal is super important. And so intelligibility and intimacy are imperative. Now, there's one other way that vocal leveling really gives you a quantum leap above not leveling, and that is sibilance control. As I'm leveling for intelligibility and focus in the mix, I'm also taking care of S's and T's and D's and any other sound that comes out and jumps out at you, especially where you know it's going to, you know, mess with processing downstream, like compression and that kind of thing, and or if you're going to vinyl, because a bad S will jump the needle right out of a record. So being able to sculpt the levels of everything else is pretty critical as well to creating an artful mix. Number 10, processing, compression, reverbs, delays, special effects, feedback loops, whatever you might do, that's part of the mix process as well. Generally speaking, I allow myself to be sidetracked at any point in time in a mix. Like if an idea comes to me, oh, it'd be cool if I did XYZ, you know, because that's going to end up affecting the way that the rest of the mix reads. I allow myself to distract myself from whatever I'm working on at a given point in time to build processing, because and to automate processing as I'm leveling, because music is episodic generally. And mixing is episodic. You can only be in one place at one time. And generally speaking, the way that I tend to level is to take a 2 or 4 bar phrase, highlight it, loop it, and do my automation leveling in that looped mode, because you can really get a strong idea of what's weak and what's too strong by focusing on just a small area. And
so, for example, when you're leveling the lead vocal, you'll select a couple bars and just loop that and tweak the break points as it plays over and over again.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll move on and do that ad infinitum until the song is done. And while I'm there, if I have an idea for processing, I will instantiate it and I'll edit that into place, because generally speaking in pop music, I mean, it's still relatively normal to have some static, you know, spatial effects processing on a vocal, but it's also pretty normal to have episodic signal processing. And so you want to get that automated in and out as you're working through the vocal, because you're concentrating on the nuance.
Yeah, otherwise, I mean, a set it and forget it mix is pretty boring. And if you just slap a delay on a lead vocal and let that go for 4 minutes, that's nothing like a magic carpet ride where the delay changes with every nuance or even sections of the song.
Exactly.
So what you're saying is you actually do use automation to automate the sends and the plugins and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Religiously. Yeah. I mean, it's not that I do. I mean, I don't necessarily. Often, I'd say probably maybe 15% of the time, I'll automate an EQ to make some sort of change. Like if there's a section where it, you know, the
needs
performance
it.
Needs it, I'll go in there. But with respect to, you know, spatial processing, at least my sends and returns are often pretty highly automated.
Right. Thank you for that. Yeah, that was a major epiphany for me, getting to automated things and mixes went to a higher level. Another thing I remember myself when I realized I could link together, I could layer effects. So you could put a reverb on a delay, for example. And I imagine you do a lot of that as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
When you have a chorus unit, you bring it back up into the mix and then you put some delay or a reverb on the chorus.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
It's like a snake eating its tail.
Yeah, and even more tweaky than that is creating feedback loops within the board, where you literally intentionally create a feedback loop so that the interplay of one event changes another.
The whole idea of taking a send and actually feeding it back into that track is huge, because then every single repetition or event is different because it changes every time it loops through, right?
Exactly right. Yeah,
that's huge.
Yeah. I mean, for some more heavier music, like, you know, hard rock, metal, punk, whatever, where you just want it to just make people sweat. You know, it's like a challenge to listen to it. Having something that's sort of out of control, like feedback, it's like there's a rebelliousness that's built into the mix. And it's really powerful. I remember doing that when I was a younger guy, but I also was really pleased. I had the pleasure of working at one point with Jim Scott, who's done a lot of work with Tom Petty and a bunch of other people. And, you know, feedback loops were in his vernacular the day that I was working with him, and he was doing some really interesting stuff. And so, you know, it's a common technique amongst successful engineers. It's tricky and it's scary at times, because, you know, the feedback loop can get out of control and be kind of painful to listen to in the control room until you get it under control. But, you know, it's exciting and unpredictable and makes interesting things happen and gets you outside your own box. The final checklist, and I actually, because I'm an old geezer and prefer to not be encumbered with too many computers in the control room, especially because I don't like having fan noise. So a lot of guys have their laptops right next to them and that kind of thing. I just have my machine room and my studio computer in that room. And so I tend to have a pad of paper to my right generally. Mm-hmm. And I have actually drawn up a few different forms that I use. And one of the forms that I use is a simple graph. It's essentially a spreadsheet where I'll write my track names and I'll have, you know, specific tasks that need to be looked after before I do a final bounce out or as I'm doing a final bounce. Mm-hmm. And those include checking for no red lights unless you specifically want them. And meaning that unless you want the sound of digital overflow in your mix, there should be no red lights present in your mixer. No red indicators in your track list, in your instantiated plugins, in your sends, or in the fader. There should be no red lights. Another thing is to engage delay compensation. You know, you don't want delay compensation engaged when you're tracking. You know, maybe you did a last minute overdub and you forgot to re-engage it. Well, you got to check before you do your last bounce out. Number three, depending on my client, I sometimes apply mastering or mock mastering, compression and or limiting to the master bus for presenting mixes. If the project is going to be mastered by a separate engineer, before the final bounce, I disengage at least the L2. And the reason for this is that mastering engineers hate to receive projects that have been maximized, because it really ties their hands. They can't do much with a project that has been maximized. Master bus compression, that's a different story. You know, you don't want to mess around with a cheesy compressor in the master bus, but if you have a good compressor and it's going to sculpt the sound in a way that enhances the overall vibe of the mix, I'm a big fan of it at this point. Mm-hmm. That has something to do, I think, with the fact that I have at least four separate stereo pairs of compressors that I like to stick into the master bus and like what they do. So, number four, mind your master level. It should be as loud as possible without overflow, unless you sound like the sound of overflow. And that's just, it's for resolution. You know, the more data, the stronger, the more robust the levels, the more data there is to describe your image. So you want your tracks hot, but without red lights.
And I think number four is connected with number one as far as no red lights. And you've used the word overflow on more than one occasion. And I think it's great to draw the distinction of unless you want them. Yeah, if you want to do that, that's one thing. But don't just allow red lights to pass simply because you can't, like, what sounds okay to me, or, you know, it's not really a problem. Only do red lights if you consciously want to create that kind of a sound. Otherwise, make sure they're not there.
Right, because unless your listening environment and your ears are finely tuned, you may not actually really hear something that where there's a small incursion into the red zone,
mm-hmm.
But somebody else might hear it, and it's there. You know, you're losing data when that happens. And again, if that's your thing, then you have my blessing. Go for it, you know, but it's not my thing. I love distortion, but I like getting it from means that I am in control of.
Right, yeah. So my final question, you mentioned that you didn't need to read the Pro Tools manual very much to learn automation, but then you said you already understood automation pretty thoroughly. So I'm going to go out on a limb as part of my RTFM read the manual sermon from Mr. Tambling that somewhere you had to read either the Disc Mix manual.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's no way you can just sit down and start trying to fly that ship just by pressing, what does this button do, right?
Or no.
The SSL automation also is a beast. So once upon a time, you paid your dues by RTFMing on automation.
I still have an SSL manual in my bookshelf for those occasions when I find myself working in an SSL room and I still feel deficient on an SSL after all these years. I just never had enough time working on one for it to all become second nature. Yeah, and so, yes, I read that manual before I do one of those sessions. I would have to give the folks at Avid DigiDesign very high marks for implementing the automation the way they have, with the caveat that I don't like. I wish that they had figured out a way to give us non-right angles. You know, it would be nice to be able to select an option where you could just, you know, highlight an area, grab it, and move it without inserting breakpoints and then having to highlight it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, other than that, I think the automation is extremely elegant in Pro Tools. I love it.
I agree. That's probably one of the reasons why it's an industry standard for mixers. There's so many different digital audio workstations, but at the end of the day, most paths lead to Pro Tools, whether you're using Logic or Ableton. Any other comments or questions?
Not today.
Okay. Thank you very much for your generous time. Signing off.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Aloha.